Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thanks for being with us for another edition of On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. And we're back at the Pentagon this week where we're going to dig into some acquisition issues for the hour. And on that front, it's a time of a lot of change in the Army in particular. The service is approaching the end of 10 years of war while still trying to meet the urgent needs of troops in Afghanistan and learn past lessons on contingency contracting. The entire acquisition system, meanwhile, is being overhauled in response to a report commissioned by the Secretary of the Army. And the Army's trying to learn how to do agile IT acquisition with efforts like the network integration evaluation at Fort Bliss. And, oh, by the way, there's the budget. With all that going on, we thought it was a good time to talk to Kim Denver. He's the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement, and he's our guest for the full hour this week. And Mr. Denver, thanks so much for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Jared, thank you for having me.
So before we get into all those fun issues I mentioned in the intro there, I want to get the lay of the land as far as your office is concerned. You're the deputy for procurement. So break your office out for me from the rest of the acquisition community, because oftentimes procurement and acquisition get used kind of interchangeably as synonyms. I think I've been probably guilty of that.
They do, and so I'll talk to that in just a bit. Let me give you the overarching layout.
Yeah.
So my office, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for procurement, my office exists within the larger construct of the Assistant Secretary of the Army for acquisition, logistics, and technology. My boss is Ms. Hsu. She is the acting ASALT right now. And underneath her are several DASs. So I would refer to her as the all things acquisition. Mm-hmm. And then she has various deputy assistant secretaries that address components of acquisition. My specific one has to do with procurement. If you look at Ms. Hsu's hat, two primary roles that she has is the Army Acquisition Executive. So that's more the programmatic side.
Mm-hmm.
Then she's also the Senior Procurement Executive, and that's the contracting or procurement side. I execute those duties on her behalf, so I'm the Senior Contracting Official for the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And so probably three main functions that I have. The first one is really the policy, that is promulgating, developing policy across the contracting enterprise. The other piece is the oversight, and I distinguish oversight from execution. The execution piece is really where you have contracting offices throughout the Army writing contracts, issuing contracts to various companies. What I do with respect to the policy and the oversight is to then go out and look at the contracts, look at their contract offices, look to develop trends, see what issues are occurring, how we might address that with policy, or how local activities need to address that locally in terms of how they're executing. The other piece is a responsibility for the workforce, which happens to be both civilians and military.
Right.
Right now we have about 7,800 contracting professionals. About 800 of those are military, both officers and enlisted, and then just about 7,000 being civilians.
Mm-hmm.
What I do with respect to the workforce side is to make sure they have the proper training, the proper certifications, what is the career path for them, and updating that career path or changing that career path as well as the training based on the latest skills sets that we need to be looking at. And so that's another piece. Then also looking at what are the skill sets or gaps that we have across the acquisition workforce. And maybe at some point in here we'll get to that and I'll talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, we'll talk a lot more about that, I think, as we get through the hour. But talk to me a little bit more first about that oversight function that you have. I think of this is another kind of acquisition 101 question, but I think of agencies like DCMA and DCAA as having that function. How are they distinct from what you do when it comes to overseeing contracts?
That's a good question. So let me talk about the oversight for a second here. You've got contracting organizations out there that issue the contracting actions. When it comes to the oversight, what we're looking to see is our contracting activities and contracting officers taking action in accordance with the policies, the procedures, contracting laws that exist. Maybe it'd be a good point here to also talk about what you mentioned before, acquisition, juxtaposing acquisition and contracting. You know, I could remember when I was at one organization. It was a PEO, a program executive office. That's programmatic side. And I was running contracting for them. I remember one time I had put a mission statement together and talked about, you know, our organization develops sound contracting acquisition solutions. Well, the program management side said, well, wait a minute, you're not acquisition. We're acquisition, you're contracting.
Right.
Well, I had to come back and say, no, we're all acquisition, you're program management, and well, I'm contracting, a piece of contracting. Then I went to an organization, the Corps of Engineers, and it was really interesting because they said, well, we're not acquisition, you're acquisition. And then I had to come back and say, no, I'm contracting, we're all acquisition. What's important about that is I think all too often that some don't recognize that contracting is a piece of the process. That whatever we're acquiring something, and I use the word specifically acquiring something for the Army to support the mission of the Army, there is an acquisition process for that. But contracting many times is the heart of it because we're right at that tail end where now we're actually working with industry to execute. But as a requirement goes through the process, that is something that we're buying. Mm-hmm. What we're looking to see is we've got various laws, regulations, policies that have to be followed. How we deal with industry. Are we appointing contracting officer representatives for service contracts? Are we soliciting? Are we obtaining competition? Are we executing the proper determinations and findings to justify the actions that we're taking? So from a contract perspective, I'm looking at how contracting actions were issued. Did they comport with laws and regulations and policies? And are we encountering new environments where we might need to modify our policies and procedures? So then what we do is I actually have a program that is what we refer to as PMR. It's a procurement management review. Mm-hmm. But we go out to the local contracting offices and look at the health of the contracting function. And there we're looking at both their oversight locally and their execution. Now, when you talk about DCAA, was one organization, or DCMA, mm-hmm. We share that. As you know, the contracting officer is the one person in all the government that obligates the government through contracts. They're the only person that can.
Right.
But before we do that, we always take professional guidance and recommendations from auditors. We take from technical personnel that talk about the product that's to be acquired. We confer with small business specialists. We also confer with the Defense Contract Management Agency that has information about companies, especially if we're going to award as to what their responsibility as an offer to the federal government. So it's a shared role in terms of oversight. But ultimately, the contracting officer, everything stops with that contracting officer. So if DCAA made a recommendation to us, it's actually a recommendation, and that contracting officer has to make a sound business judgment and use their business acumen to determine what is that right relationship. So oversight's a very, you target on something that's very, very broad. We could spend, and I'll talk as much as you want about it, but we could spend a lot of time talking about
I'm
oversight.
Sure we could do a full hour, yeah. We probably should talk about some other things. But, I mean, fair to say that all of the contracting officers in the Army come under your purview? Is that accurate?
That's accurate in a sense. They come under my purview as it relates to the authority. Mm-hmm. When it relates to supervisory control, they're under the supervisory control of their local commands, executing the mission on behalf of the mission that the commands have to execute. But authority-wise, they completely fall within our purview. And, if there are actions to be taken, matters to be addressed, yes, they certainly have to respond back to this office.
Understood. It's a great overview of the office, and we're already through our first segment. When we come back, I want to start talking about some of the changes that you've seen in this office over the past couple of years as the Army goes through some acquisition transformations. We'll be back in just a minute with Kim Denver. He is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement on DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Our guest this week, Kim Denver, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement. We got a pretty good overview of the office in the first segment, and as we transition here into this next segment, I want to start talking about some of the recent changes the Army acquisition community is undergoing. It wasn't that long ago, maybe a couple years, probably less than that, the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army said the acquisition system was kind of a mess. He said a big bang was going to be needed to fix things. I think that's part of what led to the Decker-Wagner report that I mentioned earlier in the intro. I think the Army agreed with 63 of those 76 recommendations. And from your perspective, sir, what are some of the major changes your office has seen as a result of those recommendations?
Well, in general, it was actually very broad, those 63 recommendations,
right.
Actually 76 recommendations, and the 63 that the Army concurred with dealt very broadly with acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, they dealt with the collaboration and the overlap of multiple communities in the acquisition process, the requirements community, that is that community that identifies what it is we need, the resources community, we provide the resources, and then the acquisition community, the program management community, and then the contracting communities. But mainly on that, if you remember what I was speaking with Ms. Hsu, and I talked about One side of her hat was the Army Acquisition Executive,
mm-hmm.
more that program management side and that material development side. That's mostly in that environment in terms of what it was dealing with.
Right.
As it related to my responsibilities in contracting, there were a couple of areas that were very specific. Clearly, the execution of services for the Army. In the last 2 years, services have been about, as juxtaposed to goods that we're buying or supplies that we're buying, services have been about 60% mm-hmm. of the total dollars. And just to put that in context, in FY11, we awarded $125 billion, the Army did. That was about 24% of every federal dollar and 33% of all DOD dollars. So the Army is
just in terms of the service contracting pie, or
the total dollar pie,
wow.
was $126 billion. Of that, 60% of that $126 billion was towards services.
Gotcha.
So services being about 59-60%, it's something that we've got to focus on, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But that's been a big area in terms of standing up the structure needed, the governance structure as to how we're going to manage services for the Army. And then better buying power got into that as well. The better buying power in terms of the deals that we would be constructing, the business arrangements that we would be constructing on behalf of the Army. So what things are we doing to encourage more fixed price contracting and less time and materials type contracting?
Mm-hmm.
You know, time and materials is not a favored contracting type. There may be times when it's necessary, but is it not being a favored type is because, you know, for every time you have an overrun, there's profit on top of that. So there's no real incentive to control cost. In a fixed price environment, a huge incentive to control cost, but you always want to use those contracts when your technical data packages and the requirements are firmed up enough so that an offeror can adequately propose what the cost is likely to be and not have to take into a lot of contingencies, mm-hmm. if you will, to try and price out or price in risk,
mm-hmm.
if you will. The other piece of that, also as it related to contracting, but mainly programs, is a use of multi-year type contracting in those cases where it would make sense. And that's where you're contracting for something for a period of years. That traditionally the way we contract is we contract for a base year, and then we exercise options each year.
Mm-hmm.
The government's not held to that next year option. And so we make a determination whether each year whether to exercise that option, and then we obligate the dollars on the contract.
Right.
In a multi-year contract, you do just the opposite. You commit the government to the 5 years, and then we have options to opt out of the agreement. And there's costs associated with that to the government. But the main reason for pursuing a multi-year contract is there are savings to be accumulated when you know the government's going to need that requirement for a period of years. So you're projecting that there's stability there. At the same time, you're giving companies the opportunity to have some firmness with the understanding of what work is coming. And so then they can take in some efficiencies and help price in efficiencies for that. So that's some of what was happening, at least in Decker-Wagner, as it related to the contracting function. I think we'll see more in the summer. It was really, Decker-Wagner was also process-driven, looking at the processes and how each of these communities overlapped. I think you'll see what will happen is it's about the in June time frame or the summer time frame, and where more of these processes will be implemented. But it's a more of a long-term approach in terms of seeing the effects of decisions that we're making.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to contract type, as you were just mentioning. There have been, and I don't know how much, to what extent these concerns have been put to bed, but I've heard concerns from industry and industry groups that there is a mandate out there that says we're going to force fixed price, even in situations where it's not appropriate. So say something about that, if you
would. I would tell you this. Contract type is always a discussion in every acquisition. And I would tell you that probably when I was coming through my career, even though we received some academic training on the one thing that I could say in our entire career field that requires experience is contract type.
Mm-hmm.
To answer your question, there is no mandate that we will fix price everything.
Mm-hmm.
But too often what you'll see is if you don't manage certain contract types correctly, like, for example, let's say a cost type contract where there can be overruns, it requires more oversight. And so organizations have to make sure they put that proper oversight. But I think at times Congress has seen that maybe we haven't provided the proper oversight or done the due diligence that we need to do with respect to cost-type contracts. So sometimes cost-type contracts fall out of favor, but it's not because that wasn't the right contract type. It's always about, do you need to put the right oversight? T&M is one where as I told you before, you don't really have an incentive to control cost, and so it would even require more oversight. But there's no mandate to go to a specific type. The real mandate is that we need to make sure that we choose the proper contract type for the effort that's being acquired. In fact, if anything, there's more of a push to use some incentive-type contracts that incentivize behavior, incentivize contractors to control costs, to be innovative, but at the same time deliver the effort.
Oversight's obviously an important area in the next topic I want to talk about, which is contingency contracting. Can you talk me through some of what we've learned over the last decade of war and how they're informing the way we do overseas contingency contracting going forward?
Sure. You know, we've been over there 10 years, so there are certainly a lot of lessons learned that come from this. I think some of the overarching comments that I would make is that wartime contracting is not synonymous with overseas contracting. And contingency contracting doesn't always mean wartime contracting either. Mm. I used to work at the Corps of Engineers, and there were many times we did contingency contracting, but we were responding to national disasters, right, working for FEMA. In those environments, we needed contingency authorities that provided us some flexibilities with putting things on contract quickly so that we could, at least in the disaster environment, respond quickly to rehabilitating the environment. I think one of the things to recognize in the contingency contracting that we were doing in Iraq and Afghanistan is very important to recognize we were in a hostile environment. Mm-hmm. We were operating in an environment where the technology wasn't as robust as we needed it to be in some of our contracting systems. You know, we needed to look at how we priced contracts with local currencies. Also, you know, what were the local business customs? And so you take away a lot of that, even if there was ever a situation like this in the future. You know, it's a lot of those questions in terms of what environment are we going into? What are the business norms? What are the cultures that exist? What are the second and third order effects associated with that we should control? In fact, you know, we talk about oversight, and there's a bigger piece. You know, one would say in a contingency environment, you might need even more oversight, because you're in an environment that's not stable. It's not like doing contracting back here in the States with American firms that understand our contracting process, understand our contract clauses and such. And so let me break it down into two parts for a second.
Sure.
There's that oversight of the contracting function, what I call oversight of putting the contract in place. But then there's the oversight of contract performance. And that oversight of contract performance, it takes a team. It's not just a contracting officer. Yes. As I mentioned earlier, the contracting officer is the one responsible. It all comes down ultimately to, right, to the contracting officer. But to truly provide proper oversight, it takes the requiring activity. It might take DCMA, like you mentioned before, the Defense Contract Management Agency. But in that requirements committee, it takes what we call a contracting officer representative. Mm-hmm. And so that's really some of the challenges that we had in theater with contracting officer representatives. First, it was a numbers game, getting our numbers up. That's been addressed. As of our last report we pulled in January, we had about 98% within CENTCOM, 98% fill rate for our CORs. But once you address the numbers game, it's also about addressing the capability of contracting officer representatives. They may be qualified, and it's a qualified issue and then also a capability issue. The qualified, their specific training that we have contracting officer representatives go through, but the other piece is there's a capability issue. So while they've been trained academically, there's also that part in terms of do they have the skill sets overseeing what a particular function is. So, for example, what we've had some challenges with, in theater, the Corps of Engineers does all construction contracting, was over $1.5 million. Below that, we had the CENTCOM Joint Theater Support Contracting Command. They don't have as much construction expertise as the Corps of Engineers, but they still require the same type of CORs that the Corps of Engineers has, mm-hmm, but it's not necessarily at their disposal. So what I'm saying is there are certain subject matter experts, whether it's electrical, whether it's plumbing, there's a certain skill set that's needed. It could even be in dining facilities. You know, what is the proper method for testing food or making sure it's at the right temperature and it's being stored properly or cooked to the proper level? You know, CORs look to make sure that contractors have their what we call a quality assurance plan, making sure they provide the proper quality in the service that they're performing. So while we've adjusted with the numbers, we're continuing to develop training for CORs that have the capability to oversee the service or product that is being delivered.
Mm-hmm. I want to stick with contingency contracting when we come back from another short break, because I think there's a lot there. We'll be right back with Kim Denver. He's the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement here on DOD. You're listening to Federal News Radio. I'm Jared Servin. We are back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thanks for listening. I'm Jared Serbu. This is on DOD. I'm talking this week with Kim Denver. He's the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Procurement in the Army here at the Pentagon. And we left off talking about contingency contracting, what we've learned in Iraq and Afghanistan over the past 10 years. I want to stay with that because there's definitely a lot more there. We could spend probably a couple hours on just that topic. You know, it seems to me there's a pretty broad consensus on the fact that we're never going to go to war again without doing a lot of contracting in theater. The contracting officer representatives being so important to that process, and it seems like such a special skill set, you're just going to have to surge up next time you go to war with those folks, right? I mean, that's going to have to be a capability that you either bring with you or you can quickly establish once you get into an operation, yeah?
No, that's absolutely right. The contracting officer representative is critical to what we're doing. If we ever end up in a situation where we're in a wartime environment like this again, where we're building up the infrastructure, we've definitely got to have contracting officer representatives, because this isn't about just delivering supplies, mm-hmm. water, bullets, or such to the troops. What's been very important for the Army is we signed out an execution order, 48-10, Army parlance, but it identified for all brigades that were deploying the number of CORs that they would have is up to as much as 80 CORs. What's really been important to understand for actually all of the Department of Defense is that getting that need or that understanding into the requirements community that we have to have CORs that can oversee the contracts that are being executed or being performed. And we have to have them sufficient numbers, and we have to have them with sufficient qualification and capabilities. So it's definitely going to be something that if we do this again, we've got to have, and it's one of those lessons learned that we make sure that we don't forget. But part of it has been institutionalizing it in our military construct as well, that brigades are going to also have to provide those.
I guess my real question is, once we completely withdraw from Afghanistan, do the bulk of those positions go away? And are we going to have to rebuild that workforce the next time we're in a contingency operation?
No, I mean, you ask a very good question. Those contracting officer representatives, some are additional duties that they perform, mm-hmm. but some are positions that the organizations that are requiring those have set aside to actually perform that duty. But I don't think that skill set is going to erode. What I think is more important is that those organizations understand that when we go to war the next time, we want to make sure that, one, we want to train as we fight, but we also want to fight as we trained. Mm-hmm. And so what I mean by that is we use CORs back here in the States, mm-hmm. some of them on the installations. And so the real issue is us getting our arms around what those capabilities are that contracting officers need, that they need to bring to the battlefield. In the end, I think we can address it with numbers. I don't think that the capability is going to erode, even though numbers may come down across the manning levels that we have right now. I think that capability is still going to remain.
Service contracting. You mentioned a moment ago that the idea of contracting is sort of a collateral duty, which reminded me of a comment that Ashton Carter used to make all the time when he was undersecretary for AT&L, which is that that's one of the struggles with service contracting, is that so many of the people doing it are not acquisition professionals. They're doing it because they need service contractors to sustain what they're doing for the rest of their job. So you agree, is that an Army problem as well? And just talk to me more generally about how you've tried to improve your trade craft, as they say in that area.
Sure. I think it is true that services across DOD weren't necessarily managed like programs. Mm-hmm. Maybe if they were, it was done as the exception. So when you're out working with a contractor to build an MRAP, you've got program managers that oversee it on that, remember, the Army Acquisition Executive side of the mm-hmm. house that I was talking about. But when it came to service contracting, traditionally what was happening was, well, somebody had a requirement for that service contract. But once the service contract was in place, it wasn't being necessarily managed other than by the contracting office. So what we're looking at doing now is, how do we build the proper infrastructure and put the proper oversight for the services environment to manage services like a program? Because in the end, it's so many dollars that are being delivered, and we need to make sure that the quality of the service being delivered is what is contracted for. But to do that, it's like what I said earlier, it takes a team to do that in terms of the oversight. And so traditionally, it's been mainly in the contracting environment. And so now we're saying, okay, how do we put that oversight in place and run it like programs? Mm-hmm. Part of it is how do commands identify their requirements? The Army stood up recently, actually within the last year, they stood up a DASA for services. And so that the DASA was referred to as the Senior Services Manager for the Army.
And that's on the programmatic side, the more programmatic side that you were mentioning, right?
Right, but it was more on the requirements, the programmatic side in terms of the policy that was being developed, mm-hmm. but it was very much intertwined with procurement. So as they stood up the policy, and shortly after the Secretary of the Army signed the implementation plan for services governance, he signed that in September last year, shortly after that, that Deputy Assistant Secretary office was stood down as a DASA and was folded into my office as the DASA for procurement. So actually the Senior Services Manager now works within my office and executes that governance that governance program that we have, or the oversight that we put in place. As I said, a high level, basically the governance that we have in place, where we have commanders are responsible for the services that occur within their commands. They have a responsibility to approve at certain dollar thresholds. And so we have across all the commands what we call a command service executive. It is either the commander or one level below the commander at the general officer or SES level. Below that, we have actually services divided into six different portfolios. Examples are medical services, knowledge-based services, equipment-related services. This is just a couple of examples. But we have across the Army what we call portfolio managers. That individual is responsible for that portfolio, and they're responsible for the service acquisition that takes place across all the commands as it relates to that portfolio. Mm. So ultimately now, before services go out, their acquisition strategy is put together. If it's $250 million, between $10 million and $250 million, that command service executive must approve that strategy. If it's over $250 million, it comes up to my office and the staff here. We review the strategy and then approve it. But in that approval process, it is actually going through and looking at the decisions that are making, how they're going to execute that strategy, what's the contracting going to be associated with it, what are they doing to affect savings. You may or may not be aware that across the fiscal years 12 through 16, what we call the FYDP, we've removed from the budget about $4.3 billion worth of services. But we're not stopping there. One of the things I've done is set a 5% goal for all the services that are being executed out there. So these plans that I talk about with acquisition strategies, the requirements community will have to identify how they're going to save 5% in their particular acquisitions. And it's a requirement for the approval of that plan. So we have a broad comprehensive strategy as to how we're going to run services and affect services. But a huge part of it is making sure we have the oversight on it. We have senior leader attention on it, and that we're managing it like a program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the reduction in service contracting was one of the bullets in the better use of defense dollars bucket, I think they called it, in the new DOD strategic guidance. You said you're looking for 5% across the Army. Have you given specific guidance to commanders and components of the Army as to what to target, how to achieve that, or is it just up to them?
We have given guidance out, but it is local decisions. What I'm really interested in the 5%, but then I'm interested in working with them and providing them the tools as to the areas that they can look in. So it could be contract types. It could actually even be less service that they're acquiring. You know, do you really need that much service? It could be that we use a different contract type, because I would tell you there were a lot of services out there that were being contracted for with time and materials. That's what we're getting away from. There's one contracting organization I was working with, and they were seeing at least a 10% savings just going from T&M back into a fixed price type contract or some contract in between. Usually services are more conducive to fixed price contracting, you know, especially when they're over long periods. You know, one would have to ask the question, why would you do service contracting a T&M over, you know, a 5-year period or such? So there are some local decisions that they can make. We work with them and provide them some strategies and some ideas on how to do that, also some policy. For example, limiting the use of time and materials. But ultimately, we're targeting that savings. And what we're really trying to get people to do is to look at your requirement and challenge that requirement. Does the Army really need that level or that amount of service, if you will.
But you're not targeting particular types of services across the Army, are you? Or is there a particular industry out there that should be concerned that they're going to be doing less business with the Army?
No, I wouldn't say that we're targeting a particular industry, but we do have the categories that we're really looking at. I mean, there were six portfolios. So the portfolios I was talking about, there's equipment related, there's knowledge-based services, there's medical services, mm-hmm. Transportation services. So in those portfolios, that's what we're targeting as a type of commodity, if you will, that's being delivered. There's also construction services out there and research and development services. So holistically, we're looking at those type of services, not targeting a particular industry, but just targeting the services that are being provided. And are we making sure that the level of service that we're asking for, for example, if you had janitorial service and you had someone coming in and vacuuming your office, all right, so are they coming in vacuuming, dusting every day, or do they only need to dust every other day or every 2-3 days? It's questions like that that say, look, we don't have a budget that's endless.
Right.
So we've got to make the decisions that are reasonable. And so that's sort of what we're targeting, if it makes sense.
Understood, yeah. Take one final break here. We'll come back for one more segment with Kim Denver, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army, here on Federal News Radio. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Subin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. Wrap up here with one more segment with Kim Denver, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement. And I want to use our final minutes to talk about what you're doing on the acquisition workforce front, a big topic across the entire acquisition community and DOD, probably all across government. Talk me through some of the things that you're doing and what progress you're making on growing and sustaining and training that workforce.
You know, one of the questions you asked earlier was, what did we learn in contingency contracting?
Mm-hmm.
And so probably one of the areas that I should have talked a little bit about was workforce. So let me weave that together for a second, and then I'll go deeper into workforce. You know, we talked about CORs, but I think the other piece is that we also recognized that we needed an ability to surge a contracting capability in the fight. And there's no doubt that contracting is a critical component, almost a line of operation in the fight, especially as our recent in Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts have been.
Mm-hmm.
But what we recognized was that while there are many great civilians out there, many who have deployed and true patriots, that we didn't have sufficient numbers when it came to the civilians. And so the Army also didn't have a robust contracting capability with the military. And so we learned that in future fights, in order to be able to surge, that we've got to make sure that contracting is a competency that exists within the military.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we've been doing is growing our military contracting professionals. Last year, right in about October, we briefed the secretary in terms of what we thought the size of the workforce should be. He came back and set a requirement that for each year to come and brief him as to what now should the contracting workforce look like. I would tell you that the from the secretary's office, the secretary is a huge supporter of acquisition. And as we were briefing him, he was supportive, but also was mindful that as we go through the environment with the budget, that we need to look at what is the proper size of the force with respect to making sure we take whatever it is that appropriate amount of risk as it relates to contracting. Next month, I have to brief the secretary on what this year's assessment is and what I think the next 5 years should look like with respect to growing the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, when I briefed him, we did project out a lower level of contracting activity. So in FY10, we did $140 billion of contracting, and that was about 500,000 actions. In FY11, we dropped about $15 billion. We went down to $125 billion and actually 600,000 contracting actions. But we know ultimately as dollars come down that some of the workload will come down.
Right.
But in my mind, there are things that the workforce has to execute. We execute putting dollars on contract. And so that's the business arrangement, that's negotiating the better buying power, making better deals for the government, making sure our requirements are right, making sure we're identifying that well to industry. But then the other piece is overseeing what is being executed. In fact, so I've talked to the contracting organizations and I want to start tracking as a metric the dollars that we expend, that we pay out to contractors every year. So I've got the dollars that I put on contract, but what do I pay out every year, which is really accumulation of current year and previous years, but That is the value of the oversight that we're providing of those goods and services that are being delivered to the Department of Defense. And then there's the closeout activities. So you got to have a workforce that's sized for all of that. When we went to the Secretary last year, we indicated that we needed a workforce of about 9,300. And of that 9,300, about 2,300 we were recommending would be, there's about a 75-25% ratio, 75% civilian, 25% military. That wouldn't be grown overnight. Right. But that would be grown each year, especially as it related to the military. The real growth was in the military. So, you know, over the past few years, we've been growing the acquisition workforce. As I indicated, I told you we're about 7,800 on board. You look at it and say, okay, I'm thinking we need about 9,300. Those numbers aren't final right now in terms of that's what we briefed last time. We're still working, analyzing the data and prepping the brief to the Secretary as to what we think it should be. But I see it kind of in those same general area. You know, I don't see a whole lot more growth. And even as dollars come down, the contracting workforce and the acquisition workforce collectively will have an opportunity to have better oversight. Mm-hmm. But growing the workforce, I think we've done a great job of it. The real question now comes to what are we doing with respect to training and experience. Training, you know, certification-wise, what we call the 1102, that's our series, our occupational series, 1102s, contracting specialist. They're certified at the appropriate level or within a window to get that certification because mm-hmm. we have 2 years to get our certifications. We're actually at about 99% certified in the contracting community. The real question is, what experience do they have?
Right.
And so, you know, we downsized in the 90s. We've been growing recently. So you have a lot of early career, not young employees, early career employees. Right. And so the majority of our experience lies below the 10-year mark. One estimate we had recently was about 35% of the workforce was below 8 years.
Yeah.
You know, in the day when I was coming up, you know, it took 10 years to make a great contracting officer. Right now we're making contracting officers in 5 years out of necessity.
Yeah.
And our contracting has only become more sophisticated.
And I know one of the things you're doing to fill some gaps and bring your workforce up to where you want it is to bring back annuitants into the contracting workforce. Is that one of the functions that they're performing is to help train that less experienced workforce?
It is. They serve several functions. I would tell you my the use of rehired annuitants is mainly a gap fill.
It's a numbers issue more than anything. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's to bring a capability that they have that they took with them in terms of a legacy world that you just can't grow that overnight. So we are bringing them in to come in to do some training. In some cases, they're executing actions. I have two or three on my staff right now in some very specific areas where we lacked a certain capability that did deteriorate over time. For example, cost and pricing. The person I have on my staff on cost and pricing is a rehired annuitant, a very, very specialized skill set in contracting that's needed, but that we're reconstituting across Army contracting activities. So we're looking at our skill sets, identifying where we have gaps. There's actually a study going out to identify what those skills are that we need in contracting that we're working with with DOD and our HR community. First, you know, it's a numbers game, but it's not ultimately the numbers game. It's really the experience and the quality that a contracting person brings so that we can make sound business decisions on behalf of the taxpayer.
Mm-hmm. And finally, the drawdown of the acquisition workforce in the 90s, I think, is pretty well regarded as a mistake. Is that a lesson that we've learned? Are you confident that as we go through another budget drawdown, that's not going to be a pay for through this process?
In dealing with senior leaders, here's what I'll tell you I'm confident of. I'm confident senior leaders are aware of what happened in the 90s. Mm-hmm. What I'm confident of is that senior leaders aren't seeing that there's a peace dividend to be paid with respect to contracting. That doesn't necessarily mean that our numbers won't have to shift over time depending on where we stabilize with respect to our contracting dollars and actions. But I can tell you right now, my boss, Ms. Hsu, is identifying the need for the acquisition workforce. The acquisition workforce is not right now if there are any numbers being drawn down, it is the last component of the workforce that's being looked at because we understand how critical acquisition is, that if we're going to deliver the goods and services and do it with respect to taking care of the taxpayer dollars and we make the right business decisions, that we have to have an appropriately sized and trained acquisition workforce. So I think our workforce will last. But then again, it's back to we don't know what we don't know in terms of what's going to happen in the future with the budgets. And in the end, I can only imagine how difficult the job the secretary has when he has to balance the entire mission of the Army and look at all the communities that exist. But there's no doubt that there's support for the acquisition workforce.
We are flat out of time, unfortunately. We could do another hour if we had one, but we're going to have to leave it there. It's been a great hour, though. I really appreciate you doing this, sir.
Thank you, Jared. I appreciate it. My pleasure.
We're talking to Kim Denver. He is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thanks for joining us today. Join us again next week for another edition of On DoD. If you missed any part of this show, visit us at federalnewsradio.com, search term On DoD. You'll also find all of our past shows at that site. I'm Jared Serby. Thanks for listening. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.